Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Writer Melissa Phoebos has never shied away from the intimate details of her life. In fact, her first book, Whip Smart, documented her short career as a dominatrix and her work to free herself from personal addictions. Her next book of essays, Abandon Me, dissected her various relationships with family, lovers, and her own actions in those relationships. In her most recent book, Girlhood, she unsparingly looks at the societal norms and narratives that are instilled into girls on how to act, how to negotiate conflict and gender relations, their sexuality, and their need to fulfill the expectations of others, especially men. Her book examines her own journey to reclaim her emotions, power, and pleasure through personal stories, interviews with others, literature, even philosophy. As she's learned to reclaim her ability to be the hero in her own story, she offers readers a way to avoid the confining societal norms that constricted her life. Girlhood won the 2021 National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism and is now out in softcover from Bloomsbury. Phoebos' essays have appeared in the Paris Review, McSweeney's Quarterly, the New York Times, and the Suwannee Review, to name just a few. She's currently an associate professor at the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Melissa Phoebos, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
In this collection, Girlhood, you explore a series of questions, everything from feminine identity, politics, gender stereotypes, patrimony, just to name a few. What were some of the big questions you wanted to explore in these essays?
Well, each essay sort of had its own kind of path that I went down. And it usually began with a question about my own experience, about sort of the story that I had been telling myself about my past and particularly my adolescence. So, you know, when we form beliefs, I'll speak in the first person, when I form beliefs about who I am or how things work or what is normal or what is harm, sometimes I don't think to revise those stories. And this book really was kind of an intentional quest to look back at the events and experiences of my adolescence and to really sort of reopen the case and think about how those events have continued to affect me into adulthood.
Do you think that's a pretty common experience?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I think that, I don't know, being a person is a busy and overwhelming experience, and we don't have a lot of spaces in our lives, generally speaking, where we're encouraged to stop and reflect and look at the past and consider why we think what we think, why we do what we do. I think we're sort of socialized to look outward. You know, I think a lot about how my friends or, you know, the women in my life and a lot of people, you know, that I hear talking will say, oh, like I'm on these dating apps and there's no good people. Like I just keep dating these bums, you know? And I always think, wow, like the common denominator here is you, which is, I don't say, of course, but I do think like there isn't a built-in mechanism in our culture for us to sort of look back and think, how do I have more agency in the choices I'm making and the behaviors I'm exhibiting and the patterns that I'm sort of stuck in, you know? And I think it's not fun work, you know, to look back at your past and sort of scrutinize why you do the things you do, but it's been incredibly rewarding for me personally. And So I kind of just wanted to share that experience with other people.
And to get back to the idea of those values that are instilled in us as we are entering puberty, as we are entering adolescence, they're very important. They're deeply ingrained value sets. And even if they're, you know, they're toxic in their own way, it really takes a lot of work. You know, to be quite honest, I grew up in a time when some of those boys I recognize that you write about in Girlhood, the boys that are always looking to take advantage of a girl. And I've really had to do a lot of frank reinvention and reassessing. I'm wondering how common that experience is, though. Do you think people really do take time to try to figure out where they came from, where they are today, and how they need to adapt their behaviors, their viewpoints, and really their whole set of values.
Yeah. I mean, well, first I just want to say, you know, it's interesting because I've heard from so many men who've read Girlhood and said exactly what you said, where it was like, I recognize these boys. I was one of these boys. And it feels important for me to say that, I think that these kinds of conditioning in terms of sort of gender and touch and power dynamics and sexuality, they're bad for everyone, you know? And part of what was so tricky in looking back at this is that there wasn't really any person to blame. You know, it's easy to blame a person, and that's just not where this path led back to. It was like really old social dynamics that far precede anyone I've ever met in my life, you know? And so I think this kind of, I don't know, this kind of reckoning that you're talking about, you know, it's relative. I think that there are plenty more people interested in doing it and taking on that work now than there were back when my stories take place, you know, when I was a kid. And I do think that sort of, you know, therapy and self-reflection and personal transformation is much more a part of sort of the mainstream like lexicon now, but there's still so much stigma. Like there's these built-in sort of traps that make it hard for people. And I think even particularly for men, because our sort of traditional definition of like masculinity does not have room for sort of self-reflection and self-incrimination and self-forgiveness and all of the things that are really integral to this process, to look back and see the things that could be changed and to decide to change them. It makes a person more humble and more sensitive. And that is, men are generally not rewarded for that in sort of a traditionally masculine sense.
Yeah. In the first few essays and really throughout the book, you refer back to that moment of pre-adolescence, puberty. You write of that time when puberty occurs. You know, the cliche is that it's difficult for all young people, boys and girls, the sense of awkwardness, the sense of not knowing whether, you know, the changes in your body, the changes in your relationship with your peer groups. But after reading your account, I think I'm going to bury that cliche because the onset of puberty, as you write, was incredibly difficult, toxic time for you. You, as they say, developed early, and mm-hmm. that really caused all sorts of issues in how other girls saw you, your peer girls, and peer boys and older boys.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I did. I probably, you know, I went from being, I was a really confident, athletic, sort of outgoing, kind of vigorous kid. And I should say, I think it's important to say, especially when we're talking about these topics, that I think they sort of transcend family dynamics in some ways. Like I was really privileged to have a very loving, supportive family. And there was just no way that their love and support, it just was no match for sort of the social forces that I encountered when I went through adolescence. So I was this really sort of happy, confident kid. And then when I was, you know, at the end of my year of being 10 into 11, I suddenly had like an adult body, you know, and the radical shift in the way that other people treated me, in the way that like grown men started to notice me, was shocking and pretty devastating. You know, it was like all of the values that I understood in the world completely shifted, like my value, the things that people assumed about me, and just kind of what felt possible, just totally spun 180. And of course, developing early is not that unusual, but I didn't know that. I was the only person I knew. I was the first girl among my peer group. And so it really felt like the way I became treated by everyone, it felt like a personal response. Like I had done something, or there was something wrong with me that suddenly I was being treated the way I was being treated. And of course, like in writing this book, I went and read all of this research, and it's all but guaranteed for girls who develop early. And in fact, for any girl who, and I think to a large extent boys as well, anything that makes a kid at that age kind of an outlier or different, whether it's has to do with the way that they look or class or the way they talk or anything that makes them different becomes grounds for a kind of punitive response. I mean, it really, you know, it's a cliche, but it really is rough at that age, you know, like the only thing people care about is really sort of fitting in and being the same as everyone else. And if you can't do that, like, God be with you.
Yeah. I was struck by something you said. It said, you know, I had a great supportive family, but you know, that's the whole thing I think about that time is that certainly in my generation, a child never went to their parents with questions about mm-mm. what's happening. Probably the same in your generation. It's probably the same, you know, parents are more open to reaching out, but it's not something we really want to do. It's nothing I wanted to do as a parent. And I assume so that just allows that break, you know, that mm-hmm. that understanding that, yes, I know exactly what you're going through. Here's what happened to me when I was a kid. And
right.
And I think that's one of the big issues, I think, is the idea that you have this feeling that you're all by yourself for the first time in your life.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. You know, my mother was just visiting me last week and we were talking about this. And, you know, just to say as an aside, one of the things people wonder and ask me about most is sort of like, how does your work, how does your writing go over with your family, you know? and it hasn't been easy, but I'm so grateful that she and I have like a discourse and an ongoing conversation about this because I've written about it. And, you know, I can't even tell you how many times she's asked me like, what could she have done differently, you know? And every time I say with 100% certainty, there's nothing you could have done. And it's because of that dynamic you're talking about where I felt so much shame and embarrassment. And that is just the overwhelming response that I think a lot of kids, most kids maybe have sort of feeling sort of body shame and being sexually harassed at that age. I was just absolutely mortified. And if I had gone to her, she would have helped me. She would have done anything within her power. Like, put me in a different school, like go talk to the people. But I just, there was absolutely no way that I could have done it, you know? And also what I tell her is that it's not that family support and love and accessibility doesn't help, because I do believe it created a kind of bedrock that made it possible for me to return to myself and to have sort of this self-esteem, the store of self-esteem that was waiting for me. But there's just nothing that could have prompted me to go to her and say, like, a boy at school, like, grabbed my chest today and I don't know how to respond to it or what, you know, like, there's just no way. There's absolutely no way.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that question about how did your parents react to your writings? Because, you know, I think it's been an interesting journey for your parents as well, because as you well know, your first memoir was about your time as a dominatrix, so that you spent some time doing that. Mm-hmm. And so this has probably been a series of eye-opening experiences for your mother.
That's putting it gently, Rich. I mean, I basically specialize in writing books about things that no parent ever wants to know about their child. You know, and I really do believe that there is a realm of detail that it's correct to protect our parents from. You know what I mean? The same, and it's reciprocal. Like, I don't want to know the details of some experiences of my parents, and I wish that I could prevent them from knowing some of the things I've written about. And I remember with my first book, I pitched it to her. I was like, what if I give you an abridged version where I just put little tabs or cut out the pages of the stuff that you just don't need to know? And, you know, I believe that there are some parents that would have agreed to that, but not mine. My mother's a psychotherapist. We're extremely close, similar with my dad. And they were just like, no, we want to know what other people are reading. And so I think the first one was definitely the hardest one, partly because they'd never been sort of exposed to that level of intimate detail, but also because I was so much younger and so much less capable of allowing myself to be seen in a certain way. You know, I think there's this misconception that memoirists are people who are kind of oversharers and they're just utterly transparent and don't mind talking about things. And actually, I think it's the opposite. For me, it's the opposite, that I am very private, even secretive. And, you know, with my first book, there was a very sort of tailored version of the experiences I wrote about that I gave to everyone. And they were just privy to the whole truth when they read the book. And it was quite shocking. And it's a really, really a testament to their integrity and their love, I think, that they were able to rebound from that and say, all right, let's be more honest with each other. Like, we really want to know you. So don't save it all up for your books next time. And I've been able to do that to some extent.
Well, you know, still at the same time, I mean, you're very frank in, I assume, all your books. So you're certainly frank in Girlhood and describing your first sexual encounters with a girl, you know, and, mm-hmm. and getting into just above clinical detail of that. And I'm sure mm-hmm. for a parent, that would be really, really, I mean, it's just something you don't want to hear. You just don't want to know. Your kids don't want to know about parents' sex life, and the parents don't want to know about the kids' sex life.
Absolutely. And I don't really want them to know, but yeah, I have this relationship to writing that is so unique. It really, the process of writing is a kind of truth serum for me. And maybe it's a response to my inclination in relationships and in the rest of my life to sort of be agreeable and work to make people comfortable and to sort of curate myself in a way that is palatable to other people. I've always done that. I'm a Libra, you know, I'm a people pleaser. But when I start writing, it's like these blinders come up and, you know, an instinct for compartmentalization is has arguable value in life, but in writing, it's a fabulous tool. I sit down to write and I just don't think about what anyone else is going to think. And I'm like a little hound for sort of the truth of my own experience and to really whittle my own thinking and analysis down to the bone of it, you know? And so I don't think I definitely wouldn't be able to write the things I write if I were thinking about how my mother was going to react. And I know it doesn't seem that way, but by the end of the process, I really do take out a lot. The first drafts are just, no one should ever see it. There's just too much truth. And then once I know the shape of the thing I'm writing, I go back in and I put my mom goggles on and I think about what she's going to think and what everyone in my life is going to think. And I take out everything that seems not fundamental to the story I'm telling.
Yeah, don't need to know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other beauty of your writing is the fact that the world of literature that you've absorbed also show up in these stories. Everything from Edith Wharton's writing to Marty Schaefer's Wild America, the old nature series, which I watched as a kid, as a matter of fact. So how does that add to the stories you're telling? How did the literature you've absorbed, the culture, the pop culture you've absorbed, how does that add to the telling of the story?
Well, you know, my stories are very carefully constructed and molded transcript of my own thinking process, right? Like I sometimes think of myself as the detective of my own experience. Like I'm looking at this sort of surface experience where I'm sort of behaving in a certain way. I have a kind of pattern in my life and I want to change it and I want to understand it. And so I start to look at my own life and my own history and my memories as a text, right? And I'm sort of going back and thinking, okay, here's the dynamic of this pattern I'm exhibiting as an adult. How did I get here? And I go back and, you know, I am a person like most who has been deeply influenced by other stories and other texts and music and television and literature. And so as I go back through the past, I find these sort of artifacts of my own experience that have really influenced the way that I understand the world and have functioned as kind of mirrors for how I've come to understand myself. And so when those texts really contribute to a clarity about my own experience and my own self, it feels really organic to sort of include them in the work, right? And so the stories of my childhood, the television shows. I once wrote a whole essay in my second book about the movie Labyrinth with David Bowie and all those puppets, you know? And I find that these texts, whether it's Wild America or The House of Mirth, have functioned as sort of allegories for my own experience.
in telling one of those stories, in which I believe the House of Mirth plays, well, you share the etymology of the word slut, which, mm-hmm. you know, when I was a kid, that was the ultimate shaming weapon used against girls. I'm still guessing it's used today. It was certainly used in your generation, which is a generation younger than me. What do we need to know about that word? First of all, the origins of the word had nothing to do with loose morals at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is sort of a little tool that I often use when I'm writing. And this essay, it's called The Mirror Test, started with me just thinking about my experience really in middle school and junior high when I was horribly sexually harassed. And now there's a word for it, slut shaming, but there wasn't really a word for it then. But it was truly devastating for me and really, really affected my self-esteem and my sense of myself and my self-conception. And so I was like, this word, as you said, it was just weaponized in such a devastating way. And I was like, what is the power of this word? Where does it come from? And so I went, like the, you know, nerdy English professor that I am, to my Oxford English Dictionary. And I looked it up, and with my little magnifying glass, I saw on those onion skin pages that the word slut first was used to describe a bad housekeeper, like a woman who was bad at cleaning or who didn't fully knead her bread, or like she was a sloppy housekeeper. And I thought, I get it. Like, this is a word that has evolved through time. It came to mean a sloppy dresser and sort of was used to punish and ridicule women for whatever, to sort of corral them back into participating in society in a way that compromised their integrity and sort of served men. And like in whatever way that would be most useful in whatever century or time period, right? And it sort of led to this revelation for me. I'm like, oh, this is just, it's an illusion, right? Like there is nothing to be ashamed of, but we just fear this word and its power depends on our collusion in its meaning. And if I decide that this word means nothing to me, then I don't have to feel that shame anymore, right? Like to feel embarrassed about being called a slut is to endorse the idea that a woman who enjoys sex is disgusting. And that's not what I believe. So I'm going to put this word in the garbage disposal, you know? And it really, you know, I really went back into that like child part of me who felt ashamed of her body and of her desires. And I sort of, you know, it's corny to say aloud, but I really, through this process of looking at the etymology of the word, it really helped me sort of free her.
Yeah. My guest today is Melissa Phoebos. Her National Book Critics Circle award-winning essay collection, Girlhood, is now out in softcover. Earlier, you said, you know, you're a people pleaser, and we were talking about the questions you wanted to explore. I was really struck by the essay Intrusions, and it gets into the notions of victimhood, but it starts with a creepy story that you're laying in bed and, you know, a peeping Tom type or a lurker is calling out to you in the night. And the first night, it freaks you out, obviously, as would any normal person. The second night, you have a dog with you, and the dog barks, and you go out and confront the man on the street. And I've kind of thought of that as sort of a breakthrough moment. Was it a breakthrough mm-hmm. moment?
Yeah, you know, I mean, first of all, this essay, this event of this sort of creepy lurking stalker who would come and like say horrible things outside my window, it really sort of epitomizes the basis of all of these essays, because this was an experience, like even just hearing you describe it, it's horrifying. You know, it's really a horrible experience. And it wasn't until I was like in my mid-30s that I was able to see that, because when it happened, it was so horrifying and felt so kind of isolating that I just was like, you know, this was gross, but I'm just going to put it in storage in my mind and I'm not going to think about it. And I'm going to decide that it wasn't a big deal and it didn't affect me, you know, but I didn't even realize that I'd done that until I told my wife about it in my mid-30s. And I was like, it wasn't a big deal. It didn't affect me. And she was like, you tape the curtains to the edge of the windows in your apartment. I'm pretty sure it did affect you. Right. But yeah. So the second time it happened, I took my roommate's dog outside and I was like, you need to get out of here. Like, what are you doing? This is not okay. Which now I'm like, that was pretty brave. But it was illuminating because the man just hit on me. He was like, do you have a boyfriend? Do you want to go out sometime? And it was so baffling and shocking. And it really sort of thinking back on that, it was the turning point that made me look more critically at the experience. Like, what about our culture and society and our sort of gender dynamics led to this man thinking that he could sexually harass a stranger through her bedroom window and that that would be a precursor to romance, right? Like, what about our society is so broken that that seemed like a logical path to this man? And that sent me on my little sort of detective story to figure out how that happened.
And of course, that reminds me of the story of Alex, the young boy, as you're entering puberty, that just harassed you hideously. He would spit on you. And when you finally got up the nerve to confront him, he goes, well, I like you.
I know.
It's the same thought process in play.
Exactly. And that's very much sort of, that was the work and the revelation of this book is like taking these episodes, bringing them into the light of my like adult mind. And every time I was just shocked at how horrible they were. And of course I was deeply affected by this, but at the time it really just felt like keep it moving. Right. And it really caused me to look back at the very, the everyday sort of reinforcements in that dismissal, the way that when girls are teased, they're told, oh, it's because he likes you. Right. Yeah. And how really hideous that is when you put it into a more critical context, right? That like we're taught to believe that, you know, this boy chases you around school, pulls your hair, spits on you. That's because he likes you. And like, what does that teach us to tolerate as adults? Like, what kind of behavior do we dismiss and accept as adults because of this conditioning?
A lot of thought-provoking ideas in your collection, Girlhood. Melissa, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Rich.
Writer and memoirist Melissa Phoebos speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's an associate professor of nonfiction writing at the University of Iowa. Her book, Girlhood, which came out in 2021, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. It's now out in softcover from Bloomsbury. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.